us, and your feedback is more than welcome. And I won't offer you the traditional literature review methodology data format, because you know, when you have that linear narrative, it's very good. But as I'm sure you all know, when you're involved in social research, it's not always as neat as that. So what I want to do today is much a bit messier and be a bit controversial as well, hopefully. Right. So quick context. Again, I can go into more detail about these things if you want me to afterwards, but just give me some latitude to develop my argument. I think that Greece is facing probably an unprecedented social, political, economic and cultural crisis. I know it's very cool to talk about a crisis, but I think you know one when you see one, and I think it is definitely, for various reasons, one of the biggest crises Greece has ever faced in its history. It's a sense of malaise around institutions, around processes, around democracy itself. And just as a few of the key events of the last 4 years, which have been sort of catalytical to sort of bringing about that sense of malaise, a string of political scandals, some of you may be familiar with these, two major forest fires in 2007-2009, which I think, again, really, apart from the environmental catastrophe, brought this sense of gloom and doom. And then, obviously, in December 2008, an isolated incident which became a huge crisis for the government and for society, the shooting of a 15-year-old student by police guard and the ensuing riots throughout Athens, Greece, and eventually Europe. And then, obviously, the last year and a half, the ongoing debt and deficit crisis, the EU IMF bailout plan and so on, and the austerity measures. And finally, in May 2010, day or so after the announcement or the agreement of the plan, a demonstration which turned into, well, a small part of it turned into an arson of the Marathon Bank and led to the death of 3 workers. I will explain why I'm mentioning this event, because it links to a few of the things that have been said in the literature, which I find interesting. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I just want to, I think this is quite indicative of the climate of fear that exists in Greece right now. Obviously, soaring crime rate, throughout Greater Athens region, which is marked by bank robberies and break-ins and contract killings and so on. I don't want to exaggerate the crime rate, but it is an underlying, again, sense of malaise, insecurity. These links have got up there, the links between organized crime and terrorist groups, and the link between anarchists and terrorist groups are, you know, not my links. They've been established by people investigating these things, and they've been well publicized in the media. And we're talking about a new terrorism post-2002, when November 17 was disbanded, and post-2008, I would say, when most terrorist groups, some of the key terrorist groups, managed to recruit people, extremists, from parts of the anarchist movement in central Athens. This is actually my photograph. I try as much as I can to take my own photographs from events, apart from everything else, because it saves you having to request permission to use things. But it gives me a sense of the events. So this is just a few days after the shooting, where the shooting took place, and you see almost like a, you know, pilgrimage there of young people leaving messages and flowers and so on. This is a photo of the 15-year-old student who was killed. And this is the building of the Marathon Bank about a few months after the event, and where 3 people tragically died. And this is not my photograph, but it's very simple. It's one of the symbolic photographs of the riots when the tallest Christmas tree in Europe became, went down in flames, basically. And unprecedented images of unrest throughout Athens. This is just context, but I chose to focus on this case study because this is obviously a major thing. Unrest lasted for 3 weeks. For those of you who are not familiar with details, spread to other Greek cities and 70 other cities throughout the world. more than 800 buildings were torched or looted or vandalized, and every single type of public space or building was affected. A total cost of 1.5 billion euros, which is huge. Right, so I won't go into that at all, the root causes of the crisis, because I think one thing, apart from everything else that Greeks are good at, is diagnosing the root causes of problems, but then we do very little about them. A list of potential factors, probably all of them have some sort of impact on bringing about the crisis, but what I find quite interesting is the emotional impact or the emotional expressions of this crisis. Mass depression, self-hatred, cynicism, fear, rage, wrath, blame, game, and anger, which I will talk about in a minute. This is just, I'm just diverging it for a second here. This is just a screenshot from my Facebook news feed, the day or the hour after the shooting, and this is, I won't name names, but this is a famous, well, kind of like almost famous Greek actor who, this is a quotation, "Athens need to be burnt if you want to see good," and this is something, this is absolutely reflective of, not necessarily everyone's opinions, but a good part of people's feelings on that day. People totally justified what was happening, and if you read the comments, they're very mixed. I mean, some, you know, there's a lot of it's quite heated, there's a lot of debate going on, but a lot of people, I mean, this escalated into like 65 or whatever 80 comments, and it's just one instance, but that was my sense on that night, that a lot of people for some reason felt good about what was happening. What is even more surprising, I'll come to that at the end of my presentation, is how these narratives have sort of filtered through the peer-reviewed literature, which I find interesting. Anyway, the anger, though, wasn't just abstract anger. It was anger directed at others, right? So the symptoms of the crisis, of the malaise that I spoke about, are obviously apathy, cynicism, or all the various indicators we associate with political crisis. But especially in the special angle is resistance to authority and an unwillingness to contribute your part of the deal as a citizen towards the state. So not paying tickets or fare tickets or taxes or tolls, or you know, not doing your bit as a citizen because you feel that you need to take revenge for all the bad things that have happened to you as a citizen. So that made me go back to the theory and go back to the theory of populism. So populism is what I want to talk about now. And Kasmad has this quite good definition of populism, an ideology that considers society to be ultimately separated into two homogeneous and antagonistic groups, the pure people versus the corrupt elite. Now that's the first part of the definition I'm interested in, because the second part I've got a bit of, of an issue with, but I will come back to that. By the way, as I was researching this, I found that there's a huge blind spot in the literature on populism. I mean, Delange and Matt did an exhaustive review of the literature, and we're talking about virtually every single study on populism, and up to that point, apart with very few exceptions, was either Western Europe, extreme right, mostly quantitative Eurobarometer stuff, political parties, so all studies focusing on political parties, and the narrative of most studies is, can we explain the electoral success of far-right wing political parties in Western Europe? That's the main thing, and focusing on single organizations. So I thought that looking at non-party, anti-parliamentary, anarchist, leftist groups in Europe would be quite a good sort of contribution to that discussion. And now this is, I want to just show you this. This is a book that came out a couple of years ago, and it is a great tool. What these guys have done is to collate every single poster, flyer, graffiti, communique, text, leaflet, slogan, banner that they found in the streets of Athens throughout the riots and just afterwards. It's really quite a good publication, and it was very reasonably priced, so I very strongly recommend it. I think that this is really an invaluable social history resource because we don't get to see these things usually, and according to Mudd and March and Lang, people who have worked in this area, this is one of the reasons there isn't much literature on leftist populism, because we don't have much data. So I thought this is really a good thing. When I started reading this, I noticed a few patterns. I noticed a consistent narrative of victimhood. I can't say how much of this was. Every single thing in there was about victimhood. You know, youth as victims, the people as victims, anger. You know, victimhood being the catalyst for anger. So, as I said at the beginning of my presentation, I don't have robust data. These are just sort of preliminary thoughts, which I think are sort of can lead to something. But what I found essentially was a rhetorical construction of an imagined community of the victimized, which is us, against a rhetorical construction of a corrupt elite, bankers, politicians, and so on, them. Blame avoidance and transfer of responsibility, no traces of reflection on on citizens, on behavior. Loads of contradictions and logical contradictions, like on the one hand society is guilty, and on the other hand people are innocent. Assumptions about the authors or the anarchists' self-proclaimed messianic rule, but they're here to save us, which I find quite disempowering and disenfranchising, because essentially they are manipulating, they're using populism as a mechanism of manipulation while accusing the state of doing the same. So this is really the core of my presentation today. This is a contrast between the traditional conceptualization of populism and the one I found in the data. I'm not saying that mine is better or different, it's just another aspect which I think has been not looked at enough. Yeah. Thank you. So the traditional approaches to populism, contributions like Kanavanaraditi or Laclau, which are obviously the classic ones, I wouldn't say that they equate populism to democracy, but they certainly argue that populism is either an inevitable part of democracy, as in the first case, where it's the shadow or the specter. So there's an element of visitation, of following democracy, but there's also one of haunting democracy. And then Laclau says that actually populism and politics are interchangeable. So the traditional features of populism, according to the literature, political mobilization through rhetoric, a charismatic leader, antagonism between people and elite, perception of society or people as a homogeneous body, so you completely ignore any diversity or within the population. Abt and Rubens have called it a thin-centered ideology, and essentially what I found in the traditional literature is a treatment of populism as a top-down project. So in this view is populism is a constitutive part of democracy. Now, I found three major differences in this, in my research of Greek anarchism or leftist movements, to the traditional conceptualizations of populism, and even to right-wing populism in Greece. The first major difference, the key enemy isn't just the ruling elite, it's the republic as a state as a whole. So we're not talking about a populism that tries to put forward a democratic general will. It's fundamentally anti-democratic. It rejects both pillars of democracy. The second major difference is that the left and the extreme left in Greece has been suffering from fragmentation and lack of charismatic leadership. And one thing that is widely accepted by most reasonable observers of the riots is that there wasn't any coherence, any leadership, a clear agenda or an ideology. We're talking about a very heterogeneous mix of anarchists, students, common law criminals, marginalized groups, immigrants, any, you know, students, parents, but there wasn't an ideology. So my sort of take on populism based on this is that it was more of an identity, an assumed identity of populism rather than an ideology, a bottom-up cultural thing. And the third major difference is the instrumental role of victimhood, as I said, as the catalytic legitimizer of violence, of revenge. So I think that traditionally the literature on populism has not really highlighted the importance of victimhood. So this is really the last substantial thing I'm going to talk about. It's obviously a bit cheeky to use a formula to talk about the abstract concepts, but it makes my point, which is that I think that populism isn't a constitutive part of democracy. Actually, if you think about it, populism essentially is expressed as victimhood plus anger, which leads to revenge, which implies innocence and blame avoidance. And that, for me, is absolutely against every single notion of the responsibility of a citizen, of a civic duty, of collective responsibility, of things that democracy is about. So my argument, basically, is that my observed aspect of populism, or the proposed conceptualization of populism, is that it doesn't have to be a constitutive element of democracy or the civic culture. It's a rhetorical mechanism or identity employed through active choice of individuals. It's a choice, basically. Next steps is looking at, doing this in a more like acceptable way within the social science sort of practice, and then looking at terrorists and linking populism to disempowerment. Just a final postscript. The literature on the 2008 Greek riots, because initially I thought, oh my god, there's like 30 papers on the Greek riots, perfect. I'm going to have a really nice basis to work from. Not really. I mean, with the very few exceptions which I'm actually naming, I found two extremes. One, on the one extreme, either very descriptive accounts of the facts of long-established and well-known root causes that add very little to our understanding of the crisis, or scandalously biased accounts theorizing post hoc according to the author's own leftist agenda. And actually, just so that you don't accuse me of being like, of sort of dodging this, I'm going to show you six quotes. I'm going to read them. They're in the handout. Of people justifying what was happening, saying that they felt liberated, that Greece is run by a parliamentary junta, that young people identify with, are fed up with identifying with neoliberalism, that the Marfin arsons were like counter violence to state violence, and all sorts of things. And these six references are peer-reviewed papers in the international journals, okay? So I'm just going to leave you with this thought by Nikos Demeritis and Yanis Avakakis, who spoke on Tuesday. We should stop projecting our own fears and hopes about youth and just start looking at the actual data. All right, sorry if I've run over a little, but...
Just a couple of minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.